Hello there, I'm Richard Kilgariff. Welcome to Bokomi. The OMI in Bokomi stands for the original memorable insights that we find in books by the most wanted minds in business, science, technology, and culture.
I'm Lionel Barber, author of The Powerful and the Damned, and these are my OMI for Bokomi.
This week, we're sharing OMI with one of the most influential editorial minds of modern times. And his book has been picked by someone who's had a big influence on my modern times ever since we met at university in 1988. Stuart Ford is the chairman, CEO, and founder of AGC Studios, the TV and film company behind blockbusters such as Midway and documentaries such as Lady Boss, the Jackie Collins story, which is out now. Here he is, phoning in his choice.
Hello, Bokomi. It's Stuart Ford here. I would like Lionel Barber's book on my shelf because I want to read the recollections and opinions of a man who the powerful and the damned of the financial world woke up to every morning for over 30 years.
Between 2005 and 2019, Lionel Barber led the digital transformation of the most important business newspaper in the world, the Financial Times, taking it from the stands to the screen with over 1 million paying subscribers. In his first authored book, he takes us through the looking glass to see behind the powerful facades and the damned lies of the politicians and billionaires who represent moments of monumental change in modern times. Lionel Barber, welcome to Bokomi.
Good to be here, Rich.
As editor of the Financial Times, you were given unparalleled access to powerful people on an almost daily basis. You had a reason to speak to them. Your book is a fantastic personal record of that process. But how did you feel, how do you feel, when you leave office? Is it a bit like leaving the office of Prime Minister? Do you miss it? Like you got Blair to admit, do you miss being in the thick of that?
Well, I miss it when there's a really big story. So the storming of the Capitol on January 5th this year in Washington, or, you know, Dominic Cummings testifying for several hours against his former political master. That's a moment of drama and perhaps history where you kind of wish or you'd like to have been there. But I don't miss the daily management of 560 journalists. There's a lot of pressure, working long hours. It's a fantastic job. I had the best job in journalism. But I always remember that, you know, pretty well the day I started as editor, ringing my old mentor, the great Ben Bradley, editor of the Washington Post during Watergate, and him saying, you know, when you've finished, that's when you find out who your real friends are.
And who are your real friends?
Well, you've become one. I'm on your
side. Good.
Actually, you know, it's interesting. You know, you don't get called back straight away, but the people that you've spent time and invested in relationships, they do call you back. And you hope that you've got enough of a record that they want to do. And I'm still doing some writing and talking.
Now, I hope you don't mind if we focus for the purposes of this conversation on Europe and Britain, because the book extends far and wide around the world and in terms of global leaders and global leadership and global business. But if we can keep it within the realms of Europe and Britain today, I found fascinating, one of the most fascinating insights in the book is the journey that you go on before, during and after Brexit. And your perspective through the lens of the paper, but also your personal notes and your afterthoughts. And that's what's really interesting about the book, because it's not just a straight diary like Alastair Campbell, who we interview on Bokomi for most of his diaries. There's notes and afterthoughts and reflection. And you brought it together very succinctly, and you describe how we leave Europe on the back of a bus with slogans like take back control and get Brexit done. You had we live in Financial Times as a banner, as a headline and a tagline. Do you think Theresa May and everyone else who was for Remain missed a trick when it came to language and communication to get the point across?
Look, they were completely out-campaigned, David Cameron, Theresa May. I mean, it was Cameron's campaign. And they were out-fought easily by Dominic Cummings, primarily. And the reason was because Cummings was able to come up with some very simple slogans, but it wasn't just the words, they touched emotional nerves. And so leave is a kind of positive versus remain. I mean, remain is very boring, but much more. Take back control, three simple words, which summed up this sense that we're not in control of our laws or our borders. And Cameron was reduced, as was George Osborne, to arguing in rational terms. So, you know, this will hurt us economically. And there were scare tactics too, which I think diluted the message, didn't strengthen it. And as a result, the emotion and that sort of latent discontent was effectively tapped, and that's why Brexit happened. I do blame Cameron, but I think it was a bit more than just a few fancy slogans.
But you also, in the book, take some personal and professional responsibility for not seeing it coming, and coming literally. And you say that you fatally underestimated Dominic Cummings, or did you maybe underestimate or overestimate? Sorry, the appeal of liberal democracy to the British public. Wasn't it just going to happen anyway?
I didn't underestimate Cummings. And as I say, one doesn't want to elevate him. And he is a bit of a Svengali figure. But there were other broader things happening. So if you break it down, and I've obviously spent a lot of time thinking about this, and, you know, you mentioned I was the chief correspondent for the Financial Times in Brussels during the 1990s, 92 to 98. Saw the creation of the euro, knew lots and lots of people, and I think, frankly, understood the process of how the EU worked. I worked alongside Boris Johnson, by the way, when he was making up a lot of stories back in those days. But if you unpack it, the first thing to realize is that I looked at it, along with most of my colleagues, in terms of rational economic choices. So surely the British people won't vote for Brexit because this is going to damage the British economy short term. Now, I'm not saying it's over, but it is going. There's going to be an economic cost. The second, which is playing out hugely at the moment, is what is going to happen to Ireland and particularly Northern Ireland, because you have a single market and Ireland is on the, Northern Ireland is linked to the south. You don't want a hard border because of the Good Friday Agreement. That was a serious problem, and it wasn't just a technical problem. And I think the last point was, you know, who are these people who are fighting against? Now, Farage, I think, is an incredibly influential figure. I write in the book how I certainly didn't underestimate him. But, you know, he'd never been elected in the constituency. But he, again, tapped this vein of discontent. Now, last point, liberal democracy. You say that Brexit was an expression of liberal democracy. I think I put it slightly differently. I think that it expressed a desire for more sovereignty, if not absolute sovereignty. Now, I think that's a bit of a chimera, but they wanted more control over the laws, and particularly, crucially, which David Cameron again didn't address, control over the borders and an end to sort of freedom of movement. And that was a very powerful argument, and I think you had to respect it. But other politicians were on both sides of the fence, including Boris Johnson.
Hello, sorry to interrupt. You're listening to the Bocomi Cast, conversations with brilliant minds in great company. If you'd like to spend more time in your mind with this week's guest, I recommend buying their book from our independent bookselling partner, Primrose Hill Books. There should be a link to buy in the episode description. But if you can't find it, just type the name of the book and Primrose Hill Books into your search engine. See what happens. It's magic. What do you make of the recent slanging match between Number 10 and Cummings, the former Svengali, over COVID? How would you report that argument today? What side would you take? I mean, it's telling that I'm already saying what side would you take, that actually news and reporting, everything has been reduced now to a binary you know, them or us. But would you be forced to take a side at the FT?
No, I think it's very important because the FT is a business and financial publication largely, and we have to be trusted to present facts. Now you know, so we didn't want heavy commentary interfering with that news reporting. Some people thought it did during Brexit, but I think on the Cummings Johnson, we would be looking at this in terms of, is he telling the truth? And why did Johnson choose him? Why was he given so much power? What about some of the contracts that were being awarded to his friends, admittedly during the COVID emergency? But I think it's really sticking to factual reporting, and then as a result of those facts, then drawing some opinions that you can make in the editorial pages. So, and I think there's one other point which is really, really important, which is, are these characters, these politicians and hired guns, are they respecting democratic processes, or are they shortcutting them? Are they treating Parliament with contempt? Are they, in other words, undermining our system of representative government? That's, for me, a crucial line. And it's why we were very critical of Boris Johnson and Dominic Cummings in the run-up to Brexit, where they essentially wanted to put Parliament on holiday for 5 weeks, otherwise known as proroguing.
Contempt is a word I actually wrote in the margin of the book, that then you used the word contempt. It's in your first meeting with Dominic Cummings and Matthew Elliott, his partner at Vote Leave. With a slip of the tongue, he mentions, I think I'm paraphrasing, but he mentions, you know, ordinary people not understanding the dangers of Brexit. And you let him off, and he says, is this off the record? Is the diary on the record again now? I mean, is it okay for you to report things that were off the record then, but they're now in the book?
Well, let me just correct you slightly, because I didn't let him off in the meeting. I actually said, you know, Cummings, you know, you're treating people, ordinary people, saying they don't have no understanding of economics. You're treating them with absolute contempt. And, you know, I said, this we have a lot of people who come here thinking that ordinary people don't matter. So I gave him a bit of a hard time. Where I let him off was that meeting was an off-the-record lunch, and I respected the rules. I think there's a statute, Rich, of limitations on some of these conversations. So I do reveal what Theresa May said to me about Brexit, what she thought about Trump, or maybe not on Trump, but there were conversations where I do reveal some of the people, like central bankers, Mark Carney, Mario Draghi, Ben Bernanke, the Federal Reserve chairman, I did go back to and said, look, listen, I'd like to use this material because it was off the record. I think with politicians, Cameron, for example, honestly, I think there's a statute of limitations, it's okay, and it's historical record. I wasn't breaching anything which I would regard as national security. So, you know, there were some people that I met that I have not reported those meetings.
And as a journalist, if we could talk about journalism and the BBC in particular now, you pulled the FT, really, as a leader, into the digital 21st century. And you did what many people find impossible. You got subscribers, existing subscribers, to pay for content. Mm. Over a million of them by the time you left the company. During your tenure, I mean, journalism, fake news, facts hasn't really managed to keep up to the gold standard that you came into the FT with as a banner. And there are many critics of every single newspaper company, all media, but the BBC gets a lot of criticism. We recently interviewed Patrick Barwise for his book The War on the BBC, which was illuminating. While you were in charge at the FT, Tony Hall was presented as the safe bet to take over from George Entwistle, wasn't he, after the Savile scandal. But he then became damned retrospectively because of his association with Martin Bashir. Given that the world of journalism has changed so much in the last 20 years, post phone hacking, post Leveson, do you think it's easier or harder to get a proper scoop now?
I think it's the same applies. There's just a hell of a lot more noise. People are quick to pull the trigger on stories, sometimes too quick. I mean, some of the investigations that I mentioned in the book, which I'm very proud of, I mean, there were wonderful reporters. The Wirecard scandal, which is Germany's Enron, that came, it finally, you know, we really did all the heavy lifting during 2018-19 in particular. Martin Sorrell, the President's Club. There are some great exposés. And that's about just doing the business of actually looking at sources, going back, being patient. And I think one of the problems these days, Rich, is that people are too quick to pull the trigger. They want to kind of do a gotcha story. And then editors aren't tough enough. I don't want to criticize Tony as such. He's the director general. It's a huge organization. But some of these journalists at the BBC who have their own Twitter accounts and are pining on everything, they need to be reined in a bit because, you know, it distorts the prism for the viewer, the subscriber. I think Tim Davie, by the way, has acted on that. But let me just go back to one very important point about gold standard journalism and how we got to 1 million plus subscribers at the FT. The crucial point was to establish and reinforce the brand. And we did that in a, you know, several different ways. One is to say, we are going to charge for content because it's worth it, to use that Tesco phrase. Second way, I'm going to be unbelievably tough on accuracy and have quality people. And we are going to raise prices. That's a test. So it's not just charging, but we're going to raise prices. And then we created a subscription business. So people would come back. And again, you've got to have very good journalism to be able to do that. But I think establishing a proposition that you are going to charge for content, a lot of people took too long to do that. And then lastly, one of the problems these days, and the book describes this, is how polarized the news environment became. So everything from, you know, Trump attacking the media, Brexit was very polarizing. And now you've obviously got the culture wars. So it's very difficult running a newsroom today. And then you ask me what it's like, how do I feel right now? I'm quite glad I'm not running a newsroom.
Hello. You're listening to the Bocomi Cast. If you'd like to meet brilliant minds in great company on a regular basis with a little weekly notification, please subscribe to this podcast on your player of choice. We're on Apple, Spotify, Google, and the rest. The rest are irrelevant. And please, please do like it as a favourite or star it, whatever you fancy. A little click makes a massive difference to my serotonin levels throughout the day. Thank you. And the issues are, and one of the things social media and digital media has thrown up is access to the complex wires and interconnectedness of everything. And it's a blessing and a curse, I suppose, just like the financial instruments that were so complex and created the crash by their, you know, by the fact that they were so hard to decipher, even by the people that were buying and selling them. The news and communication and ideas are also complicated. Your journalism and your team at the FT, you mentioned Wirecard and that fraud, uncovered the facts and got to the bottom of stories which people needed to know about. Do you think, just slightly back to the lobbying and Tufton Street and Vote Leave and the other groups, the Taxpayers Alliance, all that seem to come out of a similar street or even a building, has any investigative work been done on who is funding that group of people as it seeks to undermine what we would consider liberal democracy or the democracy of Britain or the way of life in Britain? And I lump the BBC in with that. So, you know, do you think this, that story is too complicated for people to understand or care about?
No, I don't, Rich. And I think it's incredibly important to follow the age-old principle, which I learned. I started my career in Scotland and then went to the Sunday Times, and I did do some work with the Insight team then, and there were some great journalists. Harry Evans had just stepped down, another mentor of mine, the great Harry Evans. Follow the money. Follow the money. That's where you'll find the stories. And you're quite right to be asking hard questions about groups that pose as think tanks, but are in fact lobbyists, and they're influencing government policy. Now, the FT, since I left, I'm very proud of this, to read it, has done an amazing job on Greensill, which was this fintech company run by an ex-Morgan Stanley banker who was close to the, very close to the cabinet secretary, hired David Cameron afterwards. And he was lobbying, he was right inside. He had an office in, he had an, you know, office in the cabinet office in Downing Street. So it can be done, but it requires patience. It requires an attention to facts. Now, this is something also which is incredibly important, and all editors, including the BBC, needs to take on board a bit more, which is, it's easy to mouth off with opinions, but actually, if you do deep and factual reporting, as in Wirecard, we showed at the FT that facts matter. It, this, you know, fake news, alternative, no, facts actually matter. This was a fraud. The company imploded. 2 billion euros disappeared. Can you believe it? The management, one's fled via Belarus, probably in Russia now. The other one's under arrest. And we've triggered parliamentary hearings in Germany where several members of the German establishment and the regulators have had to resign. And there's a huge parliamentary inquiry. So for me, there's a, it's a rather heavy loaded word, but accountability journalism is, you know, it's incredibly important. And it's very important these days for the reasons you just described, because everybody's got, there's so many sources of news, there's so much noise. You need to be able to cut through to what matters. And you've identified a very important subject, which is, how is lobbying working? How is our liberal democracy being manipulated? I mean, there's nothing wrong with lobbying per se, but it depends what's at the other end of the stick.
Yeah, there's a moment where you meet Rupert Murdoch and you wonder, does he know something that you don't when he's backing Trump and backing Brexit? Was there something he knew that you, apart from, you know, would give him credit for instinct?
Yeah, well, his instinct is pretty damn good, Rich. And if you look over the years, when people describe him as a conservative or whatever, no. He has a great instinct for the popular touch and also for winners. And that's why he went with Blair. I mean, he ditched the Tories because they were losers. Trump, he didn't like Trump at all. He didn't like the way Trump bullied Fox News. I know that because I was in New York at the time some of this was happening. But Roger Ailes, who ran then, he's now died, but Fox News, he was the evil genius behind Fox News. He persuaded Rupert Murdoch that Trump was going to win. And therefore, he was going with Trump because Trump was a winner.
And you, your encounter with Trump was, you know, I'm sure it wasn't a laugh at the time, but it comes across as quite comical with the Coke, him ordering Coke, you mirroring his order on the Coke. You know, it's farcical in a way, the way he ends every sentence with okay, as a sort of barrage of compliance. Who was the most, you know, you're very respectful, obviously, of the office of every world leader you meet. And you describe Trump as a very large man, but physically, who do you think fitted the size of their office best, and who didn't?
Just on Trump, it was like talking to Tony Soprano. And I came out, and we did have the most tremendous laugh. And I came out with a headline, a joke headline, Sopranos on the Potomac. I'd never experienced anything like it. It was like being on a film set. And he was thuggish, but sort of vaguely charming, a bit like Tony Soprano. Anyway, in my view, the person who most fitted the office, and I watched her grow, and grow and grow and grow was Merkel, Angela Merkel, a model of self-control, sort of rational, common sense, strategic, tough. I mean, she had an acid wit. You didn't often see it. But when I first met her, she was a fairly youngish. She bumped off Helmut Kohl, but she was probably among the most impressive. I mentioned Paul Kagame in Rwanda, a rather chilling figure. He'd been in power for nearly 20 years. He's often reputed to be either both a killer and a responsible for killing. But on the other hand, Rwanda is sort of Switzerland in East Africa. It's clean. It's like nothing, no other African country. I sat with my Africa editor, David Pilling, for 3.5 hours with him. It was absolutely amazing. You knew, even though he was scary, that he was a historical figure. And then, frankly, the person who just didn't come up to snuff in the end was David Cameron. And I say that because he was to the manner born, because he seemed prime ministerial. He's a big, tall man. He'd been at Oxford. He spoke well. He was fluent. But you never got the impression he was listening. And, it was a bit of a case of all brains and no common sense. And his behavior after office has been pretty disappointing. And by the way, I would say that the other person who is incredibly impressive, and he was unbelievably clever at seducing, was Tony Blair.
You're listening to the Bokomi Cast. If you'd like Omi sent to your inbox, sign up to our most wanted emails at bokomi.com. Members get to know about upcoming recordings and the chance to take part in conversations with more brilliant minds in great company. Thank you. And he's managed to, so far, pull off a very successful post-office career as an advisor, speaker, consultant. Compare and contrast that to Prince Andrew, who you meet several times in the book, who you can tell just from the shape of your words that you're not entirely comfortable in his presence. When he's essentially trying to do what Tony Blair is doing. You're going to shoot me down for saying that, but he's acting as an ambassador and using his connections and network to earn a living. I mean, to do a job. But you experience them through the book. The lens through which you see them through you is very different. Why is that?
Well, first of all, Tony Blair has made an extraordinary amount of money. And I remember asking my colleagues to look at his business. We got a couple of legal threats sort of. And we uncovered roughly how much he was earning back in 2012. And it was, millions. But to his credit, he's used quite a bit of that money to create philanthropic enterprises. He's advising governments on governance and trying to improve the civil service. And he's looking at sort of religious conflict. And, I think he's putting some of his money to good worth. And he's also shown himself to be quite right about a number of things during the pandemic. I mean, Andrew was, you've got the impression, I mean, he's certainly not doing philanthropy. He's engaging with people from the Kazakhs to the Dubai authorities, who you have to ask, well, what is he getting? What are they asking for his services? And when he rang up, essentially trying to muscle me on our coverage of the Dubai financial crisis, I essentially told him to get lost in a very FT way. But I was rather shocked. I couldn't believe it. But he wanted to have some kind of role beyond ceremonial, and he also needed money. But the company he kept, and obviously you haven't mentioned the name, but I will, Jeffrey Epstein, the financier and the pedophile. I mean, that is shocking. And it shows he wasn't alone, by the way. There were some very powerful New York financiers who also kept company with Jeffrey Epstein. But for Prince Andrew, it's shocking. And I wasn't entirely comfortable in his presence at all. No.
You must have come across, you did times when people would want something from you, whether it was positive preferential coverage, turning a blind eye, where they would put pressure on you to do or write something or not write something. And you have to become a very good, quick judge of character and have a character yourself as well. Did you get better at that through the job, or did you become more intolerant and annoyed with people trying to influence you?
Now, I got less annoyed because I was just more experienced. And you were kind enough to say, you know, I had 14 years in the job, so a long time, met a lot of people. And therefore, you kind of do get a nose for, you know, how a conversation's going. It was very rare for me not to see where the bullet was headed. So I think initially I'd just say, you know what, I don't really care about that. But I've always been quite good at deflecting. But if somebody tries to muscle me and they don't get the message, then we played rugby at the same college at Oxford, Teddy Hall. You know, I would suddenly turn a bit Teddy Hall rugby and, you know, do a handoff. Not that I was that good, but, you know, I don't like that and I wouldn't have it. And I think the last point, which is incredibly important, is I was in a unique position. I ran one of the most, if not the most important business publication in the world. It was global. We had access, as you say, in China, in Kazakhstan, in Saudi Arabia with the prince, crown prince, to Putin, interviewing Putin, interviewing Trump. And so, we had a certain stature, but I never had to look over my shoulder. I never had to worry about a proprietor or somebody saying, you have to do this. I enjoyed total editorial independence. Now, the other side of the bargain is if you screw up, or if you screw up two or three times, then your position is in jeopardy. But I don't think we did, because I had a very strong team. But I had editorial independence. And if you don't have to look over your shoulder, you can say to X, Y, and Z, you know what? I don't think this is going to go anywhere. And you have people, very powerful financiers, saying, you've got to change this reporter. Even a longtime friend of mine said, I can't deal with this reporter. And I just say, well, I'm not going to change, because if people ask, you don't do.
Yeah, it's a slippy slope, isn't it? And how did you manage the transition independently between Pearson and Nikkei?
Well, that's a great story, because I was coming to the end of my time at Pearson. They were signaling, 10 years is usually the thing. You might be able to do a bit longer. And I thought, well, I'm still, I can still do a sidestep. So what's the problem? But, on the other hand, it's their decision. So I said, well, do what you want. And then it was clear that Pearson wanted to sell. And therefore, there was an incredibly delicate position about, well, who's going to be the buyer? The Qataris are in the wings. You might get some Russian money or whatever. They were never going to buy that. But what about Murdoch? Murdoch might want to buy. So finding the right buyer, and it looked like it was going to be the Germans, Springer. And that was fine for me, because I knew the publisher and also speak fluent German. That's why I studied at university. But then the Japanese came in with this bid. So they were very respectful. They asked me to stay on. And I put in an enormous amount of work to build a relationship with this owner, several thousand miles away. So I did do 14 trips in just over 4 years. But it was an amazing cultural experience. And they were fantastic owners. They invested. They backed us. They backed us after Brexit. They backed us after during COVID. And they're going to be long-term owners.
You were incredibly lucky, I suppose. Do you feel lucky to have had that? Because had it been another proprietor, you might not have had such a long time there.
I think that's dead right. I mean, I'm not sentimental about these things. They were respectful of editorial independence. They wanted somebody who was experienced. I had the record. I was very lucky. And if it had been somebody else, maybe a few months, a year max, and then sayonara.
And you're very good at managing upwards and downwards and around in a 360 way. The breakfast you describe, I've been to the food, the way you get across the tone and the balance of power in the relationship through the food and your meetings with your bosses at Pearson, I found very funny. I've had those cold chicken salads and abstemious fruit afterwards, just to show how in control we are of everything, yeah, including our diet.
I mean, you know exactly what I mean. I mean, there are so many games that people play in order to exercise influence, and you've described the meal. I mean, my other one is when somebody like Kagame, they speak so slowly, so softly, that you're constantly craning your head. And then you've got to crane your neck, and you're almost bowing to them to hear. And then they'll pause, and you've still got your craning. I mean, there's amazing number of things that people do.
Those little details. I won't share them all because they're nuggets in the book, but Tony Blair's little button missing on his shirt incongruously. I think that eye for that detail, it just makes the diary, it brings it to life much more in terms of you feel like you're there.
Hello, sorry to interrupt. You're listening to the Bukomi Cast, conversations with brilliant minds in great company. If you'd like to spend more time in your mind with this week's guest, I recommend buying their book from our independent bookselling partner, Primrose Hill Books. There should be a link to buy in the episode description. But if you can't find it, just type the name of the book and Primrose Hill Books into your search engine. See what happens. It's magic.
Can I talk a little bit about your peer group? At the time, the group of editors, very influential editors, that would go in and out of Number 10, sometimes in pairs, sometimes on their own, or as a group when it came to Leveson or you know, the Press Complaints Commission. There's no love lost between many editors, especially from different ideological ends of the spectrum. No love lost for the Daily Mail's Paul Dacre in the book, although you do give him a bit of credit for a moment of compassion. But which living newspaper editor do you most admire now? And who do you think will be the most important editorial influence on post-pandemic Britain?
For British editors, I think Alan Rusbridger was an enormously influential and important editor at The Guardian, because he showed enormous courage in pursuing very difficult stories. Now, one of them was the Snowden affair, where they got a Pulitzer, Edward Snowden, revealing how the NSA and the secret eavesdropping agencies hacked into personal data and whatever. So that was very important. But he did a number of other very important stories. So I think he counts right up there. I think Dacre, in his own way, and I would slightly, I mean, it's not that there's no lost love lost between me and him. I mean, I think he's a slightly dark figure. He's a bit scary. And, you know, Cameron tried to treat him with kid gloves and got smacked in the face thereafter because the Mail campaign on Brexit. I mean, Dacre did authorise a complete hatchet job on me. I mean, it was unbelievable, because I decided that I would. I was awarded the Légion d'honneur from France for journalism and, you know, interest in Europe, whatever. And I had to take a decision on whether to take it. And before I'd made the decision, the Mail said, you know, you will be locked up in the Tower of London. You need to get permission from Buckingham Palace. At which point I said, expletive deleted. You know, I'm going to do it. And they took enormous, but it was a muscling. It was an intimidation campaign like they've done with others. But he's probably the other one, but from the other end in terms of tabloid journalism, because he's eclipsed the Sun. I mean, and he speaks to sort of middle England. He can be very prejudiced indeed and made up stories about immigration, everything. Now, who do I admire and who do I think? I mean, I'll leave aside my successor, Rula Khalaf, at the FT, the editor, who's, you know, a very impressive woman, journalist, editor, spent a lot of time with her. I think he's quiet, he's not really known, but he's done an amazing job in two different newspapers is John Witherow at the Sunday Times and Times. He, you know, Murdoch doesn't like his editors to take high profile. So John has been very smart. Could have done maybe a bit more to move to digital, but maintaining the quality of the paper, he's a very good, he's a very, very good technician. So I would say he's probably amongst the most influential now. I noticed that Kath Viner at The Guardian has managed to get rid of the CEO because the CEO lost in a power battle. So I'd say keep your eye on Kath. And, you know, yeah, those were probably, I'm a bit more knowledgeable also about editors in America because I've followed that very closely. But I think the best editors are the ones that can break big stories that influence the national conversation, make changes, that inform and you know, hold people accountable, but also where, you know, it's a great read. I've got the one I wanted. I would put huge high marks to Fraser Nelson at The Spectator. I think it's a great magazine. I think he's a superb editor. He has both sides of the political spectrum. It's a really fun, informed read. If you ask me who is probably the best at the moment, I'd say Fraser.
And throughout the five sections of the book, the five acts, huge names are constantly just dropping by for a coffee to the office, like Reed Hastings, Elon Musk, just about every tech leader you can think of that's influenced the, you know, the landscape from Silicon Valley around the world. Were there any tech business leaders that you didn't meet but you'd still like to meet and interview now in the future?
Well, I've never interviewed. I've met Mark Zuckerberg, but only had the briefest of conversations. I'm not sure he's the most interesting because he's very controlled in what he writes. He's obviously very important. I do know Nick Clegg, I've known for 25 years, who's now advising him and is clearly having some influence.
Sorry to interrupt. Did you said that you thought Nick Clegg was going to get eaten alive? Do you think he did get eaten alive?
No, I think he's managed to. He maybe have lost a limb, but he's actually, you know, a bit like the knight in Monty Python. He's still standing, and he's got a bit of him. I think he's having some influence, but you know, if you join an organization like that, you are going to have to make some compromises. But they brought him in to have, you know, make them a little bit more sort of political friendly, and they've set up the oversight board, etc. I think the person I would love to have interviewed, just adored, you know, would have been amazing, was Steve Jobs. Tim Cook, again, I met but not really talked to, but I think I would give him incredibly high marks. It'd be interesting. How do you succeed something like Steve Jobs? And I remember J.Y. Lee of Samsung saying to me, Apple will never be the same. Samsung's going to take over because Tim Cook won't be able to keep the engineers and he's no Steve Jobs. Well, actually, it's amazing what Tim Cook's done. So I think, I'd put those two people I'd like to sit down and talk to.
Well, I'm so glad I've sat down and talked with you today. Lionel Barber, thanks so much for sharing your OMI with Bukomi today.
Rich, it's been an absolute pleasure to share my OMI with Bukomi. I've really enjoyed it. And thank you for spending the time with me.
Lionel's book, The Powerful and the Damned, Private Diaries in Turbulent Times, can be purchased from our independent bookselling partner, Primrose Hill Books. We've got a special Bukomi deal with Primrose Hill Books, which gives you free postage in the UK. Just follow the link in the episode description. If you enjoyed this podcast and you'd like more OMI in your life, please don't forget to like and subscribe to the Bukomi Cast on your Apple, Spotify or audio platform. And follow us at Bukomi on Twitter or Instagram. There's even a Facebook page if you're that way inclined. I'm Richard Kilgariff. I hope listening to Lionel Barber has left you in no doubt that the world is full of powerful, damned, but original, memorable, and insightful people. Bye for now.